Do you agree that this hour is a little, this clock is a little bit late? Yeah? So I guess we start. The system says it's already past 3. So I would like to ask you to move a little bit ahead now, beyond antinomy algorithms. The idea is mainly. If you want to learn something from nature, it's likely that you end up with a zoo of different algorithms, not all of which are really necessary in the sense that they can really be applied also to problems where other can only be applied to problems where other algorithms are actually better. And in this sense, there was from the very beginning some tendency to arrive at slightly more general algorithms which either perform better in a sense, or more likely, or for theoretical reasons more desirable, that are able to explain differences and also sometimes explain the function of certain algorithms which fall somehow under the roof of these more general approaches. And in order to arrive at such a more general way of describing things, there are essentially 3 possibilities. Either you take just one algorithm which you have and try to formulate it in a more general sense, and in this way to have maybe something which also covers claims which have been proposed for other algorithms. Or there is a possibility on the one hand to think a little bit about the problem. Yeah, so if we do this kind of searches, is there any chance to, from the description or from understanding of this problem, to get to some kind of more general form of all algorithms which approach solutions of this problem? And the third possibility is to check how, in a more general sense, in machine learning, for example, problems of this are formalized and follow these kind of possibilities. So each of these strategies, like problem-based or theory-based or single algorithm-based, has its advantages. And so today, probably, we'll have some kind of examples of each of these 3 approaches with different strengths and perhaps weaknesses as well. And maybe to start with, it's a good idea to remember what these meteoristic algorithms are good for. So basically, it was always the main target of applications to solve combinatorial optimization problems. And so the question is whether there's some kind of possibility to formalize the idea of a combinatorial optimization problem. This shouldn't be too hard. And then after we have this, then we will see that the algorithms behave in a little bit too general sense maybe, but behave similar, that they all have these populations of candidate solutions, and they try to iterate the population towards better states. And they all have some mechanisms. This is probably what this really distinguishes the different algorithms, some mechanisms to accumulate information, either in this pheromone matrix or in the population of different individuals in the genetic algorithms. And so it might, in the case of meteoristic algorithm combinatorial optimization problems, it's quite straightforward to arrive at a definition which should be sufficiently general, at least. So we can just say that this combinatorial optimization problem, which is the target of all of these meteoristic algorithms, can be characterized by this triple, and individual entries here mean you need some kind of a search space, usually discrete decision variables, but it could as well be an infinitely fine discretized continuous space, like in the evolutionary algorithms. So it should be bounded in a sense, otherwise there is not really any chance to prove convergence, for example. So there's some kind of set which contains, which is known, yeah, and which contains the search space. Obviously, in different problems, you need some types of constraint for the variables in order to distinguish admissible from non-admissible solutions. This leaves you with some kind of subset of the solutions. And obviously, you need some kind of a function which tells which solutions are better than other ones. And this allows you to define what is a global maximum, in the sense that this evaluation function, if it's about maximization here in this case, is better than all the other ones or equal, because there is no guarantee that there aren't multiple global maxima in this solution. But typically we ask just for one of these optima. So that's what we have here, and this is somehow the framework in which most of the algorithms actually are working and finding some kind of, trying to identify some kind of relation of this F function and the solution space by making different assumptions or implicit assumptions in order to be particularly particularly well suited to solve certain applications. Now, if you want to make it a little bit more concrete, we can just check the two main algorithms which we have been dealing with so far. In genetic algorithms, well, the search space is just a hypercube of all bits, maybe a more open-ended collection of trees which we are searching through, while for ARCO we search for a subset of all links in a graph, typically with some constraints that it should be a Hamilton cycle in this graph. We may have different constraints in this algorithm. So for example, in GP we will have correctness, or in ARCO we could even, well, just think of the traveling salesman problem, ask that none of these links are intersecting, because this already will indicate that the solution is not very good. And so we can just put this as well as a constraint in the same right as we could put it into the fitness function. Fitness in the genetic algorithms, that's why there's an F probably. Here it's this kind of total pass length or global objective, which is calculated for each of the ARNs. In GP, we would like to ask for correct programs only out of all possible programs which there are, or in the same style, we also have here the non-intersecting paths as a possible set of evolution, and we only want the ARNs to proceed in this direction. And then we have particular optimization problems. So in this way, we have a nice framework which can be used as a playground for theoreticians who with this kind of approaches try to find typical mathematical results for the algorithms, which are sometimes a little bit self-sustained in the sense that they are interesting but not really particularly relevant. In some of the convergence proofs, it's always good to know that an algorithm converges finally, but if this is not really at the time which is relevant for any practical applications, then this might be less interesting in a sense. But what is more interesting is maybe the speed of convergence. If there is some kind of practically useful bound, or if we from this analysis can learn something about adaptation or the course of the parameters, how we should, for example, change during the learning the mutation rate or the pheromone evaporation rate, if this really has an effect on the runtime of the algorithm. And of course it, I'm sorry here about these two, because this one we did already in some to some extent, but just to see that there might be in ARCO there is also this intrinsic problem that you might have the situations that many passes lead to bad evaluation, while there are just a few lead to good ones, but still the algorithm likes to live on the ones which are more densely inhabited, and in this way accumulates pheromones more densely in these regions, which is not exactly what you want, but this is somehow a side effect of the automatic function of the algorithm and of the structure-independent application. Okay, so maybe let's have a look to these typical statements concerning convergence. So it was considered as a major breakthrough after the proposal of the Arndt colony algorithm that convergence can really be shown in this, and in not just in the sense that the algorithm at some point will stop, but at least under some conditions. So you need to remember what the algorithm has found so far, the best solution found so far, as well as you need to maintain a lower bound for the pheromones. And this is actually the critical point. So in the original formulation of Dorigo, this was not actually explicitly stated, but later in this min-max Arndt system, this role of the minimal level of pheromones was made quite clear. And here it serves essentially as a possibility for the algorithm to proceed to all parts of the search space, in the sense that even if there is some kind of a good solution found, by having a minimal level of pheromones everywhere, there's still some probability that the algorithm can also go to better solutions or to continue to explore the rest of the search space. So in this sense, if you have a constant minimal level, then you can show that with a certain probability, which depends on this minimal level, you will really arrive at the optimal solution. So this is somehow interesting, that there is this proof of an optimal convergence, but this is somehow, if you really want to have a sure convergence, that this probability tends to one, then you realize that the best you can do is to cool down or to decrease this minimal pheromone level to help to the convergence of the algorithm to one of the global optimal passes, that you really need to cool it down very slowly. So this can take quite a while if you really want to be sure. And it's essentially the same bound which you find also in simulated annealing approaches, where there is a similar time dependence, which is for all practical purposes too long, although the algorithm has the chance to really arrive at the global maximum or minimum of the evaluation function. Interestingly, if you take the standard Arndt system, or this, so to say, canonical ARCO algorithm, then this decrease is actually much faster. So there is this kind of a constant here, and then you can really decrease it linearly with t, and still have the same nice property, but it's not really clear how to choose the c in this statement. So you run typically into this situation where some kind of problem-specific parts in the c are unknown, that you are with probability 1/2 too large, or with a large probability to half and too large, and with an also large probability too small, meaning that if you have a very small evaporation rates, then you are likely to not really to focus on a solution. So there will be always a lot of solutions available, because you never forget what you once have been exploring. On the other hand, if the evaporation rate is very large, then the algorithm will settle into an global max, in a local maximum, and will not be able to go away, because all the pheromone is just there, and there is no tendency to move elsewhere. If like the minimal pheromone level elsewhere is already at this kind of very slow level. So in this sense, this is theoretically nice, but it's practically very dangerous, because it's more likely that you go to either this undecided or this too early decided state of the algorithm. And in this sense, although here you take much longer, you have really a good chance to arrive at the solution with this min-max algorithm, which is also confirmed by the practical applications of these two versions of ARCO. Another study is considered the computational complexity. So this is some requirement which you should ask for any algorithm. Is it, especially if it claims to approach also NP-complete problems, is there really some kind of an chance that this can be done in polynomial time, for example? And it turns out that only a very few special cases can be really solved in a rigorous way, and also for just the number of problems. So typically you consider problems like this needle in haystack, meaning that you have just a single maximum and everything else is flat. So that there is not really any information being accumulated by the algorithm, or these all ones problems, which you know already from genetic algorithms, where it's essentially a clear gradient towards the optimum from everywhere. And in this way, it seems to be like two extremes of the algorithm, but none of these really uses the strengths of ant colonies to accumulate information in its run. What you can show is that these algorithms, at least in the limit of a very large evaporation rate, meaning all the pheromones are indicating just the solutions of the of the previous time, but do not really accumulate any information for earlier cycles of the algorithm, then you get the same performance these evolutionary strategies. For this particular case, so meaning, if you remember to this classification, meaning there was one parent and one child, and you just run it another time, and if the child happened to be better than the parent, then you continue with the child. This, or what is also called like pocket algorithm, so you try a number of times and you keep the best so far solution in your pocket, unless you find the better ones, and you just exchange the ones. And so in this way you have some kind of guaranteed progress, but it can take quite a while before you really arrive anything, and also the algorithm doesn't learn about the structure of the problem in the course of the time. So this means that there is still an exponential complexity, but this particular case of the high evaporation rate is theoretically nice, but it doesn't really help to say anything about those applications of the algorithm which are practically reasonable. For small evaporation rates, you can show that there is polynomial complexity possible, but only for the case of the one max, where any kind of algorithm can solve it in linear time. What is a kind of an interesting side effect from this runtime analysis was also achieved by Gutjahr, that if you compare this min-max ant system and this trivial single ant algorithm, you make sure that both are comparable, that the pheromone amounts from the single ant match in total the ones from the many ants in the MMAS, then you see that everything depends again on the course of the strength of the evaporation rate. So for slow decay of the evaporation rate, you take longer before it finally finds a solution. Taking this into account, you find that you can have convergence which is n square for, remember these simple problems, for the min-max system, but the single ant already has an exponential runtime, so it's much slower, and this explains also, or this gives some kind of additional evidence beyond this building block hypothesis that you do much better with several ants that can combine and can cover a larger part of the search space, and this really shows here in a much better convergence rate. Okay, so this is much about this short overview over some theoretical results. Convergence can be shown towards global optimum, but in very long time only, and for certain simple problems, it is possible to demonstrate that the algorithm converges also in a shorter time, but it's not so clear how this is really realized in small problems of perhaps a more complex structure. Now this kind of second approach to more generality, after having seen that the standard approaches are kind of complex in this respect and remain restricted to some particular toy examples. And for this purpose, this so-called hypercube framework was proposed somehow as an analogy to the description of genetic algorithm in a hypercube, because we also have, we can map, as we will see, the problem also to the corners of the hypercube and the pheromones to some kind of point inside this hypercube. And on the other hand, you hope to have a slightly more general description, although this is clearly not a new algorithm like RCO4, but it's just some kind of a framework which can be used to discuss the properties of certain of these RCO variants. So there's a small step of the point of view involved here. So what you do is you are not describing the algorithm as a map from populations to populations, but you instead consider a space of, just for this traveling salesman problem, of the size of the possible parts of the solution. So if you remember to this traveling salesman problem, there were you have to select links from a graph, so there are this number of links in a graph of n nodes or n cities, and so you move the consideration of the problem into this space. So it means, for example, for this ant bin problem, where you have to tell which container has which item, then the number is just the number of containers times the numbers of items. So it would be like n times m in this case. Or for this eight queens problems, I think it should, which was in the tutorials, there should be probably n to the power of 3 as the dimension of the space the algorithm is now described in. And the main attempt is, so the solutions can be represented by the corners here. So each solution would be a list of all components of the problem, let's say of all the graphs in all the links in this interconnection graph of n cities, and you just place ones on these ones which are selected in this particular solution and zeros elsewhere. And so each solution corresponds to one of the corners. Obviously, if you only allow for n links to be selected for an admissible solution, then not the full cube is inhabited, but just some kind of a certain subset of the corners are used. And the idea is that the pheromones live, so to say, on a subspace of these solutions. And in this way, there is a possibility to follow a little bit. That's not so good. I think I rather stop this here and try to continue with an with a PDF file for the simple reason that there is some error in what you have received as a printout, and if it's not readable here and wrong in the printout, then it wouldn't make any sense to talk about it at all. Let's hope that this looks a little bit better. Yes, at least we see some bits here which are okay. So what we do is we have to, in order to move the problem from the space of solutions to this space of the components of the solution, we assume that there are m such components, like say all the edges of a graph, we represent similar formulas, but now with respect to these components. Yeah? So J denotes a component. That means we just look for each of the component of the solution, how many ants have placed, so this is the sum over the ants here, have put their pheromones to this particular bit here. So we can assume that this space of the pheromones is restricted in this interval between 0 and 1, simply by the fact that assume that all ants follow forever the optimal solution. So that's the maximal pheromone that can possibly be put somewhere. But so this would be described by this equation, where you have this pheromone level, that's the decay rate. And this is what you get in each new iteration. So obviously, because the decay rate, sometimes it's written as 1 minus rho, but some kind of a number which is smaller than 1. So you will end up with some maximum value. So this can be normalized, or for example, we can choose f such that this expression is equal to 1 or not larger than 1. So in this sense, we have an vector of such pheromone levels for each of the components of the solution, and maybe we have to make it a little bit smaller than 1 if you have this min-max algorithm, but somewhere in the area of 1. And we can write this kind of equation up here also in such a form that we have some coefficients that are multiplied with the solutions, such that this comes out again. But now the solutions are not in this kind of a list of links which are to be taken in order to get a full cycle in the traveling salesman problem, but it's a long vector where there are just a few ones for those components which are selected out of the total number of connections. So in this way, we see that this idea to represent the pheromones by some contributions based on what we have in our population makes sense. Yeah? We should consider a little bit more clearly what happens inside this space, how this is moving. For this way, yeah, we introduce, in order to have this 0-1 description for the pheromones, some kind of a normalized version where we have divided here by the total amount of pheromones, and this is what you get for visiting a certain link as pheromone. Again, number of ants, each contribution by one ant, and this is put here into this vector. Now we can just write the pheromone update rate in this way, that everything what we had here for the ant contributions plus this normalized pheromone level by each ant is hidden in the D, and we add it with some kind of a small strength related to the pheromone level each time to the pheromone and get a new pheromone vector. So this means essentially we start where we are at the given time and we move it a little bit into the direction of D. So that's what this equation explains. It becomes a little bit more intuitive in this picture here. So just assume you start with one level of the ant colony where you have three ants which for some reason have picked either these two components or these two, or maybe perhaps none of these, but particular numbers at the corner do not really matter in this case. So just assume you are in this space somewhere, and now what happens is if this solution is not used for a particular reason, or then the idea is that all the pheromones which are distributed are somewhere on this span between the solutions. So assume that this solution is a little bit better than the other one, then the extent of pheromone update will be, by this D, will be closer to the better solution. And what you do by this pheromone update rule is you just move from where you are before some level closer to the D value. So you are somehow attracted to the region in this subspace of the solution which are present where it's likely that the solution is better. So that's essentially what, now if you just think a little bit about the ant colony algorithm, what in this case would also be likely. You just put pheromones where you believe the solution is good, and so you make it more likely for later ants to move to this region. So here in this case it's just an expression of the same reasoning, moving towards some kind of a biased mean of all the present ants in the algorithm, but in this way you can really apply linear algebra in order to find out what will be the fate of this tau, whether it will finally maybe converge to one of the solution or be proportional to one of the solution, meaning that you cannot really go anywhere else, and this is supposed then to be the optimal solution of the algorithm.
Is there any relationship between any geometrical relationship between tau and D? I mean, is it just, D is just a point between those two possible solutions, and there is no criteria as to how tau reaches D? Is it a projection of one vector over the other? Are they all forming or not? They don't look from the picture.
So the idea is that D, we will see it also in a minute in the other algorithm. So D is some kind of an approximation or an sample of the optimal pheromone level given the current set of ants. So this is not really covering all the space, so you don't really know much. You should take this into account by moving the tau a little bit into this direction, but you should not take it too serious because it's just a sample. It cannot give the full characterization of the quality of the solutions. So that's why we are just moving a little bit into this D, and D is where it's somewhere on the space spanned by the solutions, and where it is on this space is determined by the quality of the solution. So here in this case, this solution is better. So by an average weighted by the quality of the two solutions, you move a little bit more to the better solution.
Okay, but there are no rules as to how tau actually reaches D in this case. It could be any trajectory.
So it's a projection in this way, and how far you get in this way, this depends on the mu. It's a little bit unfortunate. So mu is the evaporation rate. So if you have a high evaporation rate, you really take things very serious. You go close to D, yeah, which is maybe not a good idea, yeah, because the better solutions are maybe only recovered by a later iteration. If you have a low evaporation rate, you just move a little bit into the direction of D, which means that you rather wait for a number of cycles of the algorithm. So each cycle which reproduces a similar D, yeah, maybe not exactly, but somewhere, that is drawing the tau closer to the D. You're just closer, but you're just slower. But in this way, you can average over more instantiation of the problem, and most likely you are more successful in this case. Thank you for the question and the right position. So this is apparently essentially a reformulation on what you might have guessed about the uncolony algorithm anyway. So the question is what you can guess from it. So it's really like a probabilistic interpretation. So probabilities also live in the spans of these kind of marginal or extremal probabilities. So it's very much similar, for example, to cross entropy optimization, which is a more theoretical algorithm of very much the same style, but it just derives from a different background, and it lacks this combination of several arms, which might be really, as we have seen from the runtime analysis, might be really helpful for being quick in the solution. And what is also interesting is that you can prove in this way that the expected quality of the solutions strictly increase in this procedure, which transfers also to the standard ant colony algorithm. But obviously, strictly doesn't mean that it's really a lot. Yeah? Especially, so there's this, of course, this restriction somehow, in some cases, maybe the pheromones do not change, then you don't have any increase. And if the pheromones change, then it can as well happen that increase somehow goes to zero anyway, but always stays a little bit above zero. So for example, if you have always the same D in the previous, then you would move a little bit closer to it. So you always increase the expected quality of the solutions, but it's not really helpful. Then you had the chance to move directly to D in the first place. So D is not necessarily then the optimal solution. Yeah? It's just that the algorithm is really functioning and will lead to some improvement. And what is interesting about this, for example, in a general gradient descent algorithm, you always have to assume that the step size is essentially infinitesimal in order to make sure that by taking a linear derivative, you are not really jumping up the hill on the other side, so to say. Because only an infinitesimal or very small step size really allows or justifies the assumption that you can linearly approximate a certain fitness or objective function. But here, you can just prove this for some step size, which is bound by one. Yeah? So you can do quite large steps, and you are still on the safe side with respect to the statements that you improve on average. So this is a similar statement as the schema theorem. It was also like for one step you will have some kind of improvement of the good schema. The good schemata will be more likely to reproduce. Of course, it can later happen that by a different sample this original improvement is not really realized by the new solution, because it's always an expected improvement of the solution rather than a statement about what you actually get. So in this sense, it's somehow a statement which increases hope or trust in the algorithm, but doesn't really show that it must work in any particular case. In a similar way, you can also use the Hypercube framework to improve or to support a little bit the function of any particular algorithm. So, for example, there's a possibility to use some kind of a diversification scheme. So what you can do is you just take a sum over all the links which have been used, or the solution components which have been used by any of the ANTs. So this gives you some kind of inhabitant map of the solution space. And by taking the inverse of this inhabitants matrix, maybe you have to regularize if there's some region where no ant has currently been. You can just invert, so to say, the pheromones and make the ants really move away from maybe regions which have been explored too often already. On the other hand, you can also choose a measure of desirability that you just say for each of the for each of the solution components in this 2 n times n minus 1 by 2 dimensional space, how desirable are they, and put some kind of maximum, which is probably a good idea for initialization of the algorithm. So there are some kind of possibilities, but the main result is that you can really have a statement similar to the schema theorem, which tells that that the algorithm moves uphill rather than just randomly moving around. There is also an attempt in a different direction where, is it maybe, or maybe this is better. You try to characterize the function of the algorithm in a more general sense, and this is expressed by the term of model-based search. So the idea is you can have either random search, so you just start somewhere and you maybe create similar, or you just start in random positions, or you just start somewhere and try to move on from there. But model-based search means there is some kind of an different representation of the model, which in later stages of the search supports the search, either by directing it or maybe by diversifying it anew and things like this. Yeah? So this model accumulates information, and it's maybe slightly different from what is called instant-based, in the sense that there are only improvement based on the previous instances, like in a Markov approach, without adaptation of the transition matrices in Markov chains. So it looks like this, that you have some kind of an sample, which is our number of ants, for example. In some cases, you need some additional memory, which you use before you extract the information about the model. But in principle, you can also put this memory together into the model. But the idea is always that you use information from the sample in order to improve the model. So, just strictly speaking, if you work with best so far solutions, you need some kind of additional memory in order to guide the learning into a particular direction. So in this way, for example, ant colonies can be represented also in this framework very nicely, and this is one of the attractiveness that ant colonies fit in various categories and are still an algorithm which functions practically quite well. In contrast maybe to the genetic algorithms, which are a little bit uneasy in this respect. So I guess this is more or less always a repetition what we have seen before. The idea is that this pheromone matrix represents what you have seen in the past and what is now represented as a model, and according to which new solutions are sampled or maybe just searched, if it's more this kind of biological analog of an ant. it's more interesting to have a look at genetic algorithm in this sense, because this seems to be not so much of a model-based search, but rather this instant-based search. We have a population, and essentially the population contains all the information and produces a new population. So there's not really any kind of model included here that in some kind of more explicit way, or an analogy of probabilities, for example, or in condition probabilities, represents what is known about the sample. But still there is this observation that genetic algorithms, at least theoretically or in some of the applications, perform better than just this instant-based search where you start with a population and nearby create a new population. So, and for this purpose, people try to formulate it, and I think in the remaining few minutes we can just quickly go through. So just as an example, we are using a tournament selection, and we write down not just the individuals of the population, but rather, in order to have this kind of model idea present, we just write a probability vector. And so this probability vector, if you don't know anything about the solution, this is maybe 1 or 0 with any value between 1 or 0 with the same probability. But if there are two individuals battle in this tournament, then assume that A wins. If a particular component of this individual was 1, then we move this probability a little bit closer to 1, or otherwise a little bit in the other direction. So we can have in this kind of schematized genetic algorithm, which do not represent individuals, but just the probability how individuals look like, represented in a similar way like our generalized ant colonies, where there is just some kind of difference between A and another one, or maybe between A and the mean of the population, if we would have this analogy a little bit more closely. So in this sense, it's there is some kind of a model, but this model has no relationship to the function of the genetic algorithm, because we would like to see in this P also this schemata and building blocks and so on, but here's just maybe some kind of bias into certain directions that a certain bit is maybe more likely than another one, but what schema implies, or the exponential increase, or the tendency for exponential increase of schema implies, is that there are some correlations between different bits. Yeah? So if this bit is on and this bit, then maybe most likely another bit is also switched to a particular direction, and this would encode a certain schema in the population. And so there are a number of attempts how to express this. You can just write down a large correlation matrix as a model that represents correlations among the bits, and so to say probabilities of schemata in the situation. But ironically, so the best way how to express this is by Bayesian networks, so that a model for a genetic algorithm is maybe rather by having some kind of a network of different probabilities. So if these bits are on with these probabilities, then there's a probability for another bit to be on as well. This perfectly agrees with the schema theorem, and is of course a departure from this original idea of genetic evolution. So that leads us to the conclusion that genetic algorithms are maybe historically quite interesting, but they can essentially be replaced by some more modern algorithm, although in some cases it might be more computationally more efficient to use a genetic variant rather than to have this kind of full-fledged probability distribution and all their interrelations to work.